We are in a series where we are looking at the big story of the Bible and all the little stories as it fits into this. And this morning, we're still in part of the creation story, the narrative that tells us how God made everything and how it all fits together, what the purpose of it is. And this morning, we're going to look specifically at the creation of the first two people, and out of that, see that the Bible's actually saying something deep to all of us. What it's saying something to all of us about why we're on this planet, what is our purpose, why are we here? And those are the questions that we struggle with. We want to know, you know, what's my purpose in life? What is life all about? Why am I here? Why is it so hard? How do I make sense of the world and all those sorts of things? And what the Bible does very early in the story is it lays out why God made people, and therefore it really answers those questions. I don't know about you, but I actually enjoy philosophy. I'm one of those weird guys who likes to read philosophy, and like to read guys who write about philosophy, and I like to think on the deep end of the pool, those things. I like to read what's really going on when Descartes says, I think, therefore, I am, or to read stuff that comes out of Plato and Aristotle and their debate, and just struggle with the ideas in philosophy. One of the interesting things that's going on in our world right now, and while you may not like philosophy, let me just let you know that what is being discussed in the philosophical world today becomes the mantras of the pop culture world about 10, 15 years later. So philosophy does matter. What's being discussed in classrooms, what's being discussed in ideas, what's being discussed by these guys who are, you know, just thinking, and you think, man, they've been smoking a lot of weed because what they say doesn't make sense. What eventually happens is their ideas, the ones that kind of take dominance, become what comes out in all the other pop culture. It's the ideas that will be shown in our kids' shows. It's the ideas that will be shown when you watch cartoons and when you go to Disney movies. It will be the ideas that you will hear on Oprah. I mean, just the philosophy of the age, the philosophy in the classroom is always about 10 years ahead of the working out of that philosophy in pop culture. And there is actually a crisis in philosophy right now. And the crisis in philosophy is, you know, because if you understand philosophy correctly, it's just basically trying to answer the question, where do we get purpose? Where do we get meaning? What is life all about? Well, the crisis is this: as the philosophical worldview or the ideas that have permeated our culture, especially on the secular campuses, on the universities, things like this, where this thought has taken place, where naturalism has taken hold, there is no longer any search for meaning. In other words, if we just literally came through naturalistic processes, there is no way to find any true meaning or purpose in life. Now, we get this. We send our kids to school, and they show up at school, and this is now not a blasting of Eureka High School. Okay, they got some really cool, even Christian teachers who teach in the sciences here. But generally, when you walk into a classroom, when you come to a high school, or you go into a college and you walk into a classroom, they stand up and say, welcome kids to Biology 101. We're glad you're here today. We're going to learn a lot this semester. We're going to learn about rocks and trees and bugs and slugs. We're going to get to cut open a frog. Or in my high school, we cut open a shark. That was weird. And we're going to learn all this stuff. But here, the first thing I want you to understand, the first thing we want to teach you is this. You are a cosmic accident. You did not come by any real process that where there's a God. It is just the coming together of a whole bunch of circumstances, a whole certain set of issues that, you know, molecules just hit together, and all of a sudden it started with just a one-celled animal and just started going forward until here we are. You know, that there was a one-celled animal that became a fish that crawled out of the water, that became an ape, and then the ape shaved, and now we're here, right? And you are nothing more than a cosmic accident. Ring, ring, class is over. Okay, boys and girls, here's what we want you to do. Go out the classroom, go down the hall to the left. We have started a new class for you today, a class for you to learn to have good self-esteem. Do you hear the mix up here? We want to look at our kids and say, feel good about yourself. Look within. Feel great about who you are. While at the same time, we're looking them right in the eye and go, there is no purpose. You came from nothing. You're going to nothing. There is nothing that really matters in this world. Make the best you can of it. There is no purpose in life. You are just a cosmic accident. Or in other words, it's from goo to you by way of the zoo. And so some of you are like, oh, I get that now. That's funny. Okay, you can laugh. It's all right. And so what happens is, in our culture, the people who are writing and thinking and doing philosophy have come to the conclusion that the discussion on meaning and purpose is meaningless. And it's come to the point where one of the most current people who are key in the world of philosophy has said, humanity only has one philosophical question left to debate, and that is the question of suicide. In other words, if there's no purpose, there's no meaning, why do we even just go on living? From that have come all kinds of ideas in our culture, all kinds of stuff, but what happened, and this is kind of a big picture overview, but what happened in the 15th, 16th, and 17th century is we had a shift in the way the world thinks. And the shift was from God as the subject and the object and us as the recipient. In other words, when we ask the question in philosophy of where do I find meaning of life, before the Renaissance, before the Enlightenment period, the answer was we find it in God. But what has happened in the last 400 years, which you've never even thought about this, most of you, but what has happened, there's been a shift to where now meaning, value, purpose no longer comes from understanding that the ultimate existence is God. It's now I look within. I found meaning in myself. I'm finding my own meaning. This comes back to Descartes. I think, therefore, I am. Now, it's a very interesting thing. I'm not going to wear you out with philosophy this morning, but the bottom line is what he is saying is the only way I know anything is that I myself think, and therefore I know I exist and I know I have purpose because I think. But it's a shift from my purpose and meaning comes from God to my purpose and meaning comes from within. And the common mantra today is if you want to find your purpose in life, just look inside yourself. You can be whatever you dream, whatever you feel, whatever you want. Just look inside yourself. You will find your own meanings, your own purpose. There is no purpose with a capital P. There is no meaning with a capital M because people who talk about these things, if you really rationalize it out, they're just going to say, listen, we just got here by random chance. We can't find a big purpose, so you make your own. But if you take that far enough, you actually end with hopelessness. There's no value. There's no meaning. There's no real idea in living. The biblical, when the Bible was written and given to the people of the world, and you know, especially the first few chapters of the Bible, they also lived in a world where there were all kinds of spiritual ideas, all kinds of struggles, all kinds of different ways of seeing the world. And in the midst of this, there is the true God, the God who created all that exists, showing his people what it looks like to know him as their God and to trust in him. And no matter what the culture says, to learn that we don't look within ourselves to find meaning, there is one who gives us meaning. And as the Bible unfolds the story of creation, it tells us how the first two people were created, how Adam and Eve were created, and their creation matters because what is true of them is also very much true of us. And so we're looking at the story, this amazing story of this. But a guy named G.K. Chesterton said this about the way our secular world sees it. He says, as a politician, the secular person will cry out that all war is a waste of life, and then the philosopher will admit that all life is a waste of time. The secular person goes first to a political meeting where he complains that the natives are being treated as if they were beasts, and then he goes to a scientific meeting where he proves that all human beings are actually our beasts. G.K. Chesterton. In other words, we live in a world, he was a Christian guy, and he said, but we live in a world where even the discussion about this just doesn't make sense because it's just kind of look within and it kind of conflicts. At the end of the day, the biblical worldview calls us to see that we were created by God, for God, in the image of God. And this little phrase, the imago Dei, the image of God, is so important. In fact, as we're doing this kind of study, we're going to take like 4 weeks on the creation story. So the creation story is kind of one story, but we're slowing down, like pulling the emergency brake, breaking it down into little chunks because so much is said here. And actually, some theologians have said that the entire rest of the Bible is a commentary on what happens in Genesis 1, 2, and 3. The rest of the Bible is just a commentary on how God steps into the story that was created in Genesis 1, 2, and 3, and that this story is also our story, and we have to understand what the Bible's teaching us about ourselves, about our purpose, about our meaning. And so here you are this morning, going about your life, living busy, having kids or not having kids, having a job, doing the stuff you do in the world, just going at the pace of life. We as especially Eureka, West County people, you ask people, how are you doing? And you know, the good classic answer is fine, but the answer after that is, how are you doing? The answer is, we're busy, right? We are always going to a ball game or to an event or from something. Our lives just keep moving, keep moving, keep moving. And these questions that are deep inside of us just keep building, but we just keep pushing them down because of the pace of our life. We keep going. But down deep in the recesses of our soul, we are raising up this question, why? Why am I here? What is life all about? Why does stuff like Bob Lancaster's story this week, why does that happen? How do I make sense of it all? But then we get busy again and it just keeps getting compressed, compressed, compressed until one morning we wake up and we find ourselves totally depressed, totally disillusioned, totally not knowing how to make sense of the world. And what the Bible wants to do is it keeps wanting us to draw us back to this little phrase in this passage. And it wants to tell you that God loves you, he cares, and you are created in such a way that is so beautiful and so rich and so wonderful. You were created in the image of God. The Latin phrase, Imago Dei, and I throw that out not because I want you to think I'm cool, because I can throw out a Latin phrase, okay? It's still, I mean, something that is used in all kinds of books to talk about the Imago Dei, the image of God, that there is something in you that comes from God that is a reflection of who he is. You are somehow a reflection of God on this earth. And first of all, you gotta realize that no self-esteem class can say something higher of you than that. Our hope is not to build our self-worth by looking from within. It is to rejoice in the fact that we were created in the image of God, that God has said, I've created you in my image after my likeness. And so we see in this image of God this very important idea of what it means to be human at the very core. So if you have a Bible, grab it. Turn to Genesis chapter 1. We're going to read through the story. Then what I'm going to do this morning, because of time, I'm going to tell you how Genesis 2 then retells the same story. I'm not going to read Genesis 2. I'm going to double dog dare you to go read it yourself and see it in here as I kind of explain what's happening in Genesis 2 and how it relates to Genesis 1. But we're going to read Genesis 2 starting with verse 26. If you don't have a Bible in your Roser's Bible, we want you to grab one of those. Feel free to take one of those as a gift to you. If you don't have a Bible that's your own, you'd like to give one away to a friend, that would be great. Grab one of those, and we're, you know, real early. Page 1, page 2 is where we're going to be at in this. And we're going to read this text. We're going to look at the creation of the first two people, and then by extension, what that says about all of us. Verse 26, then God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the heavens, and over the livestock, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air, of the heavens, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. And God said, behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the face of the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit, you shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the heavens, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has breath of life, I have given every green plant for food. And it was so. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening and there was morning the sixth day. Now, if you were here last week or you listened to the sermon online, you realize that this is in the midst of the story of creation. There are 6 days laid out. There is a rhythm. And we talked last week about what is happening here is that God is literally singing a song over his creation, or he is telling a great epic story, and he is inviting us in. He is realizing that he has placed us on his stage as the creation of everything, and the history of the world and the universe is actually telling his story. It's actually where we get the word history. His story. It's not our story, it's his. And what God has done is he's invited us to join the story. And he created you here to join the story. But our problem is that rather than wanting to be part of this great epic of being a small player in a great story, of filling the role that God has created for us, we want to pull out and create our own play. We want to do our own show. We want to sing our own song. We want to make ourselves great instead of realizing that God has made us to display his glory, his greatness. And that's where our struggle comes. And on the sixth day, God's already made all of the animals that are on the earth, and now he stops. And there's actually a couple things that happens. There's a change of language and a change of the way he makes. Before, God has been speaking, but he has been speaking from himself into the chaos. And as God speaks, it happens. And so God speaks into darkness and says, let there be light. And there was light. All right, you get the idea. God has been speaking into the chaos, but now God, instead of speaking into the chaos, he has a conversation with himself. Very interesting thing happens here, as it says, the Bible says here, God said, let us make man in our image. And without telling you all the different theories, I actually firmly believe this, that as God is revealing himself even to Moses, who doesn't fully understand what's going on here, what God is letting him know is that there is within the Godhead a community, that God is Trinitarian, that there is one God who exists in three persons, and God is now having a divine conversation within the Trinity, and he is speaking purpose. He is speaking meaning. In other words, God who is in community is now speaking within the community about who we are supposed to be and his purpose for us. And that's big. There's a lot of stuff here. Because we say God is love. We came out earlier and we showed you a great video and we had a prayer that said God is love. If we begin to say God is love and we don't believe in the Trinity, we will end up very quickly with a needy God who had to create us because he wants to love somebody. He doesn't have anybody to love, so he creates us to love. And that's not the biblical picture. The biblical picture is that God in Trinitarian relationship is love, has always been love. He's eternally love. And within the Trinity has had this expression of love that has overflown. And now he creates human. He creates you and me. He creates Adam and Eve. He creates a universe, not because God needs the universe. It is the overflow of his greatness and his love. It is not like he's a half-empty cup who needs something to fill the cup. It is that he is an overflowing cup that flows into the creation of all that is. And so you and I are here because God is love. He has always been love, but now that love has overflown into the creation of people. If you're a parent, you get this. You hold that first little baby in your hands, and it's crying, and it's pooping, and it's making messes, and it's annoying, and gets you up in the middle of the night, and something that goes off on the inside of your heart where you're like, I could never, ever love anything more than this. And then you have a second kid. And something happens. It's just weird. Your love doesn't get divided. It gets multiplied, right? It doesn't become like I love you 50% and I love you 50%. It's like something has happened where my love for my first child is now, it's overflowing so that it flows into the second child and then third, fourth, and fifth for us. And you love each of them as individuals, but it's not like your love is divided, it's multiplied. There is something that happens in the love of our heart that grows and it flows out of us and it multiplies as we have more people in our life to love. And the ability to love began when I was born. It didn't like just show up because, well, all of a sudden I have somebody to love, therefore I can love. It's that I can love and now that just wells up. And this is part of what God is doing here, that God who is love, who has existed eternally in Trinitarian relationship, out of this community of faith creates us, and he creates us a little bit like himself, and there's something in us. But he doesn't create us because he needs us. He creates us out of the overflow of the love that he has for within the Trinity, but now it spills out to his creation. God is love, and he creates out of love, and he has a Trinitarian communication. And in the midst of this, he says, let us make man in our image after our likeness. In other words, what's going on here is that there is an imprint. There is an image that is created. There is a picture that is being painted as God who is spirit now has created beings, that there is an imprint of his character, of his nature. And he doesn't give us everything there is to be God. In God, he is omnipotent, meaning he is all-powerful. He is omniscient. He is all-knowing. He doesn't give us that part of his character. But there are things about his character, his moral being, who he is as a God, things that about himself that he has literally put a little bit of himself into us. And he has imprinted his image, his likeness. The idea of image and likeness here, often in ancient world, you would have statues of kings. And those statues were actually used as places to say that whoever stands near the statue is representing the king, or you would have the imprint of the likeness of a king on a coin, much like we have on our quarters and our dollars. And I, you know, if I held up a quarter and said, "Who is this?" our answer would be, yeah, those of you who aren't sure what kind of coin I'm talking about, on a quarter, I would say, "Who is this?" And go ahead, say it again. And I would say to you, "This is a piece of metal. It's not George Washington, all right? It's not a who, it's a what." But there is an imprint of the image of George Washington on a quarter that when we look at it, we know exactly who we're seeing. And what God has done is he's put something into us, and it is designed, Adam and Eve, it is designed you and me, so that in his creation, now we have the imprint of God, so that our lives now are showing him in such a way that whenever anything in creation looks at us, it sees where we come from, it sees who we represent, it can see the character of its maker in the beings that he has made people, you and me. Adam and Eve. And so he makes these first two people, he makes them in his image and likeness, and he makes them for his glory. And this means, this is so important, that our value, our worth, who we are, begins with this, that all human life is beautiful and sacred. One of the interesting things, back to philosophy just for a second, is that there is great debate on what gives human life meaning, what gives it worth. And when there is no God, there is no purpose. Now the discussion in philosophy, philosophy is what gives a person worth. You know what the answer is? Their abilities, their capabilities. What can they do and give back? And so a person who is brilliant and teaches in an Ivy League school or can lead a business, their worth is huge. But an aging person who's in a nursing home and dying, they can't do a whole lot for themselves anymore. And the worth is now being compared to capabilities. And then you have the overcorrection of this in our schools where they don't know what to do with this because they know here's this little kid who maybe has Down syndrome or this little kid who just, you know, they're not as bright. And they struggle in school. And they know we live in a world that looks at them and says, you really don't have any worth because you cannot work anywhere that will make a lot of money and give you a lot of value. But we know we can't look at them and say that, so we don't know what to say. So we create all these systems that just make the playing field level, and let's get rid of grades and anything else because we might make some people feel bad about themselves. And this all comes out of the fact that we are now the center of our existence. We find our meaning within ourselves, but when we really look at it, we go, there's nothing. And what the Bible is trying to tell us is that your worth does not come from what you can accomplish. It comes from the fact that you're created by God in his image. All human life is sacred. All human life. Human life that is unborn to death is sacred in God's hands. And we do believe that all human life is sacred. We are an unashamedly pro-life. You need to hear me say this. We believe that a person created in the image of God who is not born is created in the image of God. We also believe that a person who has had an abortion is created in the image of God and deserves the same love and grace and treatment from us. And we are so quick to fight for one section of society while just despising others because they disagree with us. And I will tell you, church, that that is a misunderstanding of the Imago Dei. That I have this crazy, weird thing in me. And we're going to find out why next week as we look at the fall. I have this crazy, weird thing in me that causes me, that leads me to tend to look at people. And even though I understand Genesis 1, 26 to 31, that we're created in the image of God, that I look at people and I evaluate them based on myself. Do they disagree with me? In my mind, they're less of a person. Am I smarter than them? In their mind, they're less of a person. Do they work at a job where they're just behind a counter and they're just a face and they don't matter to me? They're just somebody there to serve me? I just gloss over and don't look at them. And I tend to see people, not because I consciously want to, but because I'm a sinner who needs redemption, I tend to see people not in the Imago Dei. I tend to see people as objects to serve me or somebody where I can justify myself, make myself feel better, look better, because at least I'm better than them. And in a culture that does this, then you have, I mean, I was at the hospital this week to see Bob, and my heart just wept as I watched a family open a van door and pull out a girl who, it was obvious, was so deeply disabled that she probably is never able in her life to have a conversation with her parents. And this is what the Imago Dei says. That person has such deep and glorious intrinsic value because she too is an image of God. She is an image bearer of the God who created her. And God has chosen through this person to display his character and his glory in her life as she bears his image. And so what this passage does, it pushes us both to look at ourselves and say, what gives me worth? It's not my accomplishments. What gives me worth is that I'm created in the image of God. But it also pushes me to look at any and all other people and to value who they are, value their life, to stand for life because they are in the image of God. Deep worth, deep value in the human that comes from who created them and the purpose for their creation. And so he creates them. It also goes on and says that he created them male and female, which means gender matters in this discussion, that there is differences between what it looks like to be a guy and what it looks like to be a girl. And I'm ever thankful because my wife is different. Now, there's times I look at her and go, but today the differences drive me crazy. But there's a lot of other times where I look at it and I'm like, I really like the fact that you are not like me, that you are different, that you are shaped differently, that you are softer than I am and a lot less hairy. That's a good thing, right? That the gender matters in this and that God makes Adam, God makes Eve, each is fully in the image of God, but there is something beautiful as God has created them for each other, where Adam is in the image of God, Eve's in the image of God, but the bringing together of the two of them multiplies that image in a glorious and beautiful way. And he makes them for relationship. And so they are created in the image of God. The image of God matters, the image of God and gender. And so what happens is the story is told in Genesis chapter 1 and 2 as it lays out this idea. We just read the text in Genesis 1 where God says, let us make man in our image after our likeness. There's then a poem that kind of recites this again. And then he talks about having dominion, having rule, having authority over the earth. He talks about be fruitful and multiply, which is that he's right off the bat saying have a lot of babies. We believe that having babies is a good thing at Genesis. We believe it is part of the mandate that comes even from this passage, that having children, it may not be something God has for everyone, but in general for the human race, getting married and having babies is a good thing. And so as you have children, we are to fill the earth, subdue it, and we are to be caretakers in the earth. And then what happens is Genesis 2 kind of retells the story. And if you read, you know, you go to Wikipedia and read it, somebody will throw this out there. If you're in a classroom, they will say, I'll show you right away there's problems with the Bible. We actually have two different stories that come from two different traditions, two different ideas, Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, and they contradict each other. No, it's not that hard, okay? Genesis 1 is like a camera that you are looking at the creation story with a wide-angle lens. Okay, now I'm not a photographer. Those of you who are probably could tell this better than I do. But if you don't know what I'm talking about, a wide angle lens, if you were standing on the edge of a field and you had a wide angle lens, you could take a picture of the entire field. You could spread out and see panoramic everything in the field. And you bring out all the beauty and all the colors and all the glory of this field in one photograph with a wide angle lens. And so Genesis 1 is the wide angle lens. It begins with heaven and earth, all of creation. It is this wide angle picture of everything. And in the middle of the story, part of the picture, part of the frame, part of this panoramic view is the creation of humanity, Adam and Eve to begin with. And God makes them in his image. And then what happens is Genesis 2, they switch the lens. takes the panoramic lens off, puts it in the camera bag, and he now puts the telephoto lens on. And standing in the same exact spot, looking through the same camera, now you can take a picture of that bluebird that's in a tree 200 yards away and make pictures where the bluebird looks like it's a monster in a photograph. Because you've gone from a wide-angle lens to a telephoto lens. That's what happens. Genesis 1, wide-angle lens. Genesis 2, telephoto lens. Now this idea of the image of God, the creation of humanity, is going to be looked up close, and we're going to see how God relates to his people in a perfect world in the garden that he's put them. And so the story is going to tell us the theology in Genesis 1. It's going to lay out in story in Genesis 2. It's going to tell us we were created in the image of God in chapter 1. And it's going to show us how this shapes out in Adam's life and ultimately in all of our lives as it tells the story in chapter 2. And so what we have in Genesis 1 is this cool story. I mean, just picture it for a minute. There's this universe and this world, and God has created everything. It is perfect. It is beautiful. It has not fallen yet. And in the midst of it, that God has been speaking things into existence, but now he has a divine conversation. Picture that garden. Picture as God forms out of the dust of the earth. And Genesis 2 is going to tell us that once he had formed Adam, once all the intricacy, the crazy intricacy of the human body was formed by God. The complexity of the eye. The beauty of sex. The wonder of miles and miles and miles of blood vessels and veins and a heart that keeps it running. Once God had formed this, that God does something he hasn't done with anybody. He gets down in the dirt, and we see God being very earthy here. And God who is spirit, but it's picturing this in image-driven language. God who is spirit gets down, and rather than just saying, come to life, that God literally gives the first man mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. He breathes the breath of life into Adam. And what it says is that Adam became a living spirit. That the life, unlike the life in the animals, the life in Adam is literally the life of God. The breath of God. The spirit of God filling his heart. And now, I mean, wouldn't it be fun to just like be able to go back and have some like real story? Like, it would have been awesome if God could have made a DVD of this so the rest of us could watch it. Because I often wonder what's the first thing Adam said when he kind of came to and looked around, and he's a full-grown man. There's no baby. There's no adolescence. Hadn't gone through puberty. He's a full-grown man. He just wakes up and starts looking around and start trying to make sense of the world. And then he is relating to his God and all this kind of stuff. I mean, I have no idea the answer to that. But it would be interesting to be there, right, and see it. But in the midst of this, it's telling us this beautiful story. But here's what I want you to realize in this. In Genesis 1, 2, and 3, it's telling us the story of Adam and Eve, the first two people. And very specifically, Adam, this first man. And what happens is that we are to read the story, we are to realize that this story is actually our story. That every person ever, every one of us in here, as Genesis 1, 2, and 3 is told, Adam's story is my story. And it's my story on a couple of levels. And the first way that Adam's story is very clearly my story is that Adam is my representative. Now, this is a biblical idea. As you wrestle with the whole story of the Bible, Adam now represents all of the human race. He is the representative for all human beings. And so what the Bible now says about Adam as an individual, it says about all of us in compilation that he is like the theological term, he is our covenant head. And what the Bible's going to teach is that there are only two covenant heads in the Bible. We are either in Adam or we are in Christ. Those are the only two options. If I am in Adam, I have followed the path of Adam in Genesis 1, 2, and 3. If I'm in Christ, that God has done something more. So all of us are in Adam, but some of us have added to that the fact that we have found a different representative. We are in Christ. And that's the big question. Am I just following the path of Adam, or have I found a new leader, a new representative? Now, we get this. It's Super Bowl Sunday. We get the idea of somebody or people who represent us, and their story is our story as they represent us. If you listen to sports talk radio and you listen to people call in and talk about the Rams, you'll hear this guy call in, and he will say, all right, this is what we need to do. We need to work harder. We need to draft the right people. We need to make sure we have a good defense. We need to get a better coach. And there's all this language about we. And what you realize is this guy who is saying, we need to do this, we need to do this, we need to do this to play football games. On Sunday, that guy is sitting in his recliner eating Cheetos. He is not on the field, but he has come to believe that the team is his story, that they're his team, and their victory is his victory, their loss is his loss, their injury is his injury. They represent him. This is what the Bible's trying to do. When we look at Adam, his story, he is my representative, and everything that happens in his story is also true of me. But then it goes on to tell, you know, as we read the Bible, he's not only our representative, his story is not our story just that way. He's also our prototype. In other words, the reason he's our representative is because every single one of us take the same path. It's very easy to look at Adam and go, why'd you eat the fruit, dude? But if I take a step back, I go, well, the truth is I would make the same decision because I make the same decision every day. I would rebel against God because I find ways to do that and become my own God every day. And so this story is our story, and as it lays us out, the question is, why am I on this planet? What is my purpose? Well, as it's telling us this about Adam, it is speaking it into our lives, and it's telling us we are created in the image of God. Theologians have debated for centuries about what this means, and there's all kinds of ideas about this, but at the bottom, I just want to share with you three implications real quick about what I think is being said about what it means to be made in the image of God. In other words, when you wake up tomorrow morning, you go, why am I on this earth? I think this text is saying you were created in the image of God, and at the very least, it means that this is why you are here. This is why you exist. And the first thing that defines our purpose here, the first thing that we find in this is that he was created to relate to God. He was created as a relational being to relate to God. He was created to know God, to walk with God, to be intimate with God. The language that's used later in Genesis 2 and even alluded to in Genesis 3 is that Adam and God walked together in the cool of the day in this garden. I mean, just think of that. Our family, with Grace and Mary being old enough to do this, and Josiah, we've become hike takers. And there are trails all over Eureka. We just love going to these trails and just going for hikes. And the reason we love it is good exercise. We're getting everybody in a little bit better shape. But there's just something about walking together in the cool of the day. There's something deeply relational, deeply connected. And that's what's going on in the garden, that God made Adam, and now Adam is created to have a relationship with his God. He's created to know his God. He's created by Trinitarian God and community to be a relational being. And at the core of his relational being, he is made to relate, to know God. This is why the great church father Augustine said this. He said, you have made us for yourself, and our heart is restless until it rests in you. Adam was made for a relationship with God. He's created to be known and to know God. And the very core of who you are, the very purpose of your existence, the reason you are breathing, sucking up air on this planet, first at the core is you were created by God to know God, to be connected and to be relational with the God who created you. You were created for relationship, and the center relationship you were created for was God. Now, we're going to find out next week that's broken, that's twisted, that's messed up. And here we live today. We don't feel God. We don't feel connected to him. And if we don't know Jesus, the truth is we are disconnected from our God. We can't know him. But that's why you're here. You are literally on this planet created in the image of God so that you would know God. And just like Augustine said, your heart will be restless until you find your rest in him. The second thing that we were created on this, we were put on this earth, is we were created to represent God. Created to represent God. So what happens in the story is God says, all right, I'm going to give you this planet, this pale blue dot to Adam. He says, I'm going to give it to you and to all your descendants. This is my gift to you. You live here, you enjoy it, you celebrate it, but you are now over it. You are to represent me on this planet. And he says, you're to subdue it, you're to have dominion, you're to fill the earth, you're to multiply, be fruitful. That language is all language. It says, here is the purpose of people. You're to make this place your home, you're to fill it, and then you are to represent God on this planet. And that is still part of what we are to do. We are called to live on this earth, not to represent ourselves. We are called to live on this earth as representatives. This means we represent God in relationships that we have with our husband or wife, with the people we work with people in our community, with our neighbors. We were created to be a representative of God here. We were created to be representatives of God as we care for the earth. And as we just say, man, God's world, he's put me here. I represent him. What does it look like to represent God as a caretaker for his planet? We're created to represent God in our job, our work, in these different ways, okay? And so God puts Adam, puts Eve here. They are to represent God. They're to relate to God. They're to represent God. They're to live as his agents, as his representatives, caring, taking care of his earth, and just being him as his image here. And then the third thing is we were created to reflect God. We were created for his glory. In other words, God created us. And the whole Bible spells this out, that God created us so that our lives would literally reflect the glory of the God who made us. That the imprint is that we are showing not our own greatness, but the greatness of our God. That you were literally, that this is who you are. This is why, like the Westminster Catechism says, the chief end of God, of man, the highest purpose of man is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. Relationship, glory, that we are to reflect this image of God. And so in a very real way, this is what the Bible's trying to teach us, that we are mirrors, that God has created us so that our lives are a mirror. And then what happens is he shines his glory into our lives, and now we become a reflection of that glory so that his image, his beauty, his wonder, his majesty is now bouncing off of us, reflecting to the world around us so that it can be seen. And very much like if you ever been on a camping trip, you need to start a fire, and you took a mirror and you put it in the sun, and the sun hit the mirror, and then you put it on like a pile of leaves, and gradually the heat coming off that mirror can literally ignite the leaves. Literally, God has designed us so that our lives would take the glory of God and reflect it back to a world, and there will be heat, there will be fire, there will be beauty that comes out of our lives as we are glorifying God. Now, next week, we're going to see where Adam and Eve say, I don't want to do this, I want to live for myself. And since their story is our story, it's also our problem. Our core problem is that we are mirrors designed to reflect the glory of God, but rather than stand in relation to God so that our lives reflect him, we have flipped the mirror around, turned it so we can just gaze at ourselves. And as we did that, the mirror got broken. And really what we are is our lives are a broken mirror that's turned in the wrong place. As we just look at our own beauty and smile and think all of life is good because I can see myself. And ultimately what we need is God to do a work in our lives where he fixes the mirror and turns it back where it's reflecting the right thing. We were created for the glory of God, that our lives were to be a reflection of who he is. This is what it means to be created in the image of God. This was Adam's purpose. This is your purpose. You are on this planet, sucking up space, breathing God's air, taking care of his stuff, and you are here to have a relationship with your creator, to represent him on this planet, and to be a reflection of his glory. But we don't do that. And so, well, I'm going to skip over why, and we're going to talk about that next week. What we find is the Bible begins to take this story and show us this. It takes us forward to Jesus, and it says, okay, since Adam, we haven't been able to do this. That we still have the image of God, but the image of God is broken. It is twisted. It is tainted. So that it's still there, but there's something crazy wrong. But then somebody shows up. His name is Jesus, and he is in the image of God. He does have a perfect relationship with his Father. He is God's perfect representative. He lives his life for the glory of God the Father. And he does all this. And what the Bible begins to say is the only way you and I can come back to this and begin to experience what this means is to gaze on him, is to look to Jesus and gaze on Jesus. And so 1 Corinthians says this. In 1 Corinthians, it says 3 verses 16 through 18. And I skipped over this yet. But when one turns to the Lord, the veil is removed. Now the Lord is the Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. And we all, with unveiled face, beholding the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into the same image from one degree of glory to another. For this comes from the Lord, who is the Spirit. What's this mean? This is what it means. Real simple. God is saying that we are a broken mirror. It's turning the wrong direction. We don't reflect his glory. And so the way that we can come back to seeing the glory is to look to Jesus, who is the Lord, who has come. And he was a perfect representation of the glory of God, that he was the perfect image bearer of God. And as we turn and begin to look at him, that we will be so consumed by him that our lives will then become that mirror again that reflects that glory back out. And that is all aided by the work of the Holy Spirit in our lives because we have trusted Christ. And so Romans 8 tells us that who God foreknew, he also predestined to become conformed to the image of his son. God is fully committed in his people to restore the image of God by making us like Jesus. That's how the image of God is restored in us. And so if you're here today, you may be, you know, like, hey, I'm just checking this out. I don't even know what all this means. Just want to encourage you, man, you're either in Adam or you're in Jesus. If you're in Adam, the only way to have that change is to trust Christ, to give your life to him, to look at him as the reflection of God and see his death and resurrection as your story. Just like Adam's story is your story, now Jesus' story becomes your story, and to trust in him. And if you're here, you're a follower of Jesus today, just realize that God is totally, fully committed to restoring his image in you. And the way he's going to do that is by conforming you to the image of his son. That's the hope of this story. And that's your purpose. Jesus, we love you today. We pray that you will open our eyes to our purpose on this planet and the reason we exist and just lead us today. And for that, we give you praise. We thank you for your work in our lives and how you have given us your image and what that means, but also how you're restoring your image in us. In your name I pray. Amen.